Welcome to another episode of Crossing Cultures. This will be our final episode of season 5. In today's discussion, Phil and his co-host, Dr. Brian Howell, continue their conversation with Dr. Mark Yarhaus, a leading expert in the topic of gender identity. If you're just discovering our show for the first time, we invite you to explore our early episodes where we engage in many thought-provoking discussions. Our past conversations have covered topics including race in the gospel, abortion, the Ukrainian refugee crisis, and more. Stay updated with our upcoming episodes by subscribing to our channel on the podcast platform of your choice or on YouTube. Regardless of what platform you use, make sure to hit the bell on our profile page to get notified when new episodes are posted. New seasons and conversations are in the works, so don't miss out on the opportunity to subscribe and stay notified. You can also follow us on Facebook or Instagram at crossing.cultures. And now, here is our next episode of Crossing Cultures titled Exploring Perspectives on Gender Identity.
Hi, my name is Phil Metzger, and in 1992, I moved to Moscow, Russia. From there, I lived in the beautiful Central European country of Hungary, where my family and I spent the next 20 years living, learning, and sharing about Jesus. Different foods, culture, and language, but underneath it all, we discovered the most amazing people. We learned that to share the gospel effectively, we had to adjust. We had to cross cultures. Now we're back in the U.S., and we're discovering that this country is a melting pot of culture. This show is committed to helping Christians connect to those who think, believe, and live differently than them. This is Crossing Cultures.
In our previous episode, Dr. Mark Yarhaus gave our listeners three definitions to describe the different cultural perspectives people have towards the idea of cross-gender ideologies. Cross-gender ideologies are sets of beliefs that challenge traditional views on gender. They embrace the idea that gender can't be confined to just male and female. The three lenses we are about to discuss are different viewpoints on cross-gender ideology. We wanted to recap these lenses to give a framework of where today's conversation will go. The first lens is called integrity lens. This view holds that there is an integrity to gender based on the definitions found in the Bible, specifically in Genesis 1 and 2. In the context of Genesis 1 and 2, God creates Adam as male and Eve as female for the purpose of becoming one. The integrity lens states that male and female were designed for a specific function within life and marriage. This idea is sacred to anyone holding this lens. Once someone adds cross-gender ideologies within the mix of God's intent for creation, that person is going against the integrity of the male and female differences intended by God at creation. In short, people who hold this view typically see cross-gender beliefs and practices as a moral concern in which the individuals holding those beliefs or living out that lifestyle are in sin against the integrity of God's intent for creation. The second lens is called the disability lens. This view holds that there are sometimes variations that occur in nature. For instance, when pertaining to a person's gender identity as man or woman, the vast majority of people will correspond to their biological sex found in things like X and Y chromosomes and reproductive organs, meaning most people typically default to identifying as the gender that they were presented with at birth. However, this view also holds that there are rare instances in which we see a variation to this reality. Some individuals might identify with a gender that they were not initially presented with at birth. In this view, someone who chooses a different gender identity than the one assigned to them at birth is more or less struggling with their designated gender assignment, much like a paralyzed person might struggle with walking, hence the name disability lens. Because of this, the disability lens refers to cross-gender identity not as a moral violation like the integrity lens, but as a variation that occurs in a small amount of the population. Our response then to this variation or disability should be a compassionate response. The disability lens also differs from the integrity lens because people from both a religious or non-religious background or belief can often hold to the disability lens. Whereas people in the integrity camp often hold some sort of religious or moral belief that attributes to their perspective on the matter. Christians who typically find themselves agreeing with the disability lens agree with the gender definitions found in Genesis 1 and 2. However, they pull from the fall of man found in Genesis 3, where sin entered the world and corrupted all of humanity. The fall has corrupted all of creation, including our sexuality, which gives an answer to the variations we sometimes find in an individual's ideas of gender. The third and final lens is called diversity lens. Much of our Western culture is rapidly moving in the direction of this viewpoint. This lens holds the idea that the variations that we described in the previous lenses are not a moral concern to be corrected or a condition to be sympathized with. Instead, they are an aspect of diversity to be celebrated. Cross-gender thinking should be viewed as an emerging culture, meaning people who don't identify with the gender assigned to them at birth should be equal to those who do. Most Christians holding this lens typically find cross-gender beliefs and ideas as another aspect of God's handiwork or creativity within creation. In our previous episode, Dr. Mark Yarhouse didn't share these lenses to prove which one was more correct or incorrect. Instead, he shared all three lenses to help the listener evaluate for themselves which aspects we should take to heart and which ones we should disregard. As a Christian, it is not about a moral code, sympathetic attitude, or celebratory posture. Our faith and how we see people should be based on the lens God sees them in. This is not always a straightforward lens. In fact, it can be as complicated as Jesus telling the woman caught in adultery, "Neither do I condemn you," i.e., sympathetic approach. Immediately after that, he told her, "Go and sin no more," i.e., moral approach. This is why, first and foremost, Paul encouraged the church of Colossae that whatever you do in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. Colossians 3:17. Jesus also expressed this idea after a scribe asked him, "What was the most important commandment?" Jesus responded in Matthew 26:37-40, saying, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." As we begin this episode, Phil responds to the lenses presented in our previous episode by saying this.
When I heard you say that in the last that podcast I listened to, it really was like my eyes kind of were opened. And you're right, just by information, just the straightforward kind of like, here's a few different approaches that people are taking, it gave me kind of empathy on all sides. It gave me a sense of like, okay, there's a reason for that. Whether I agree is not the main issue at this moment. It's more to just understand. And you're right. It also did that for me where I said, oh, I'm not this lens, but I realize, oh, I see these things from this lens, a little bit from this lens, and I'm trying to understand this lens. So it's a very helpful tool. I want to dive into your written work on that because I think it was very helpful. Brian, you were going to, I cut you off. You're about to ask something.
No, not at all. I don't want to pivot us to a different topic, but it did make me think of this conflict that happened recently, or maybe kind of is still happening in the PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America. There's a pastor in St. Louis. I won't go into all the details, but he identifies as a gay Christian. He's celibate, but he identifies as a gay Christian, and he was charged. Do you know the details on this, Mark? He was charged and like brought before a tribunal within the denomination. Because they said it was, you know, a disordered identity, that to be gay is a disordered identity. And so to call himself a gay Christian was to sort of celebrate sin. Like, even though he is very explicit about his celibacy and his, you know, sexual ethics and his, you know, absolute fidelity to, you know, the marriage order and all of that. And I think he was cleared in one way, but now there's still like people who are trying to change some of the rules in the denomination to get him to revoke his ordination. And yeah, it's the integrity lens versus the variation in nature lens. But I can only imagine that somebody who is experiencing these things would have a very hard time embracing the integrity lens like that, because then you're kind of saying, like, what are you saying about yourself, right? If you were to embrace that.
Well, and I think in that case, and I'm familiar, somewhat familiar with it. And I think in that case, I've known other people where the language of gay, to use the word gay, as an adjective in front of Christian has been a real question of can you do that and be a Christian? And so it's come down to this. And I did a study of 300 celibate gay Christians that was published in book form called Costly Obedience. And it was just kind of on how they're like, what is it like for them as celibate people to like live out this path? Like here they are, just as you described, Brian. And in a sense, they do draw from different lenses because they're drawing from the integrity lens to say a biblical faithful starting point is the creation story and God's purposes for sex and gender and creating the covenant of marriage. And so they begin there. But they also obviously incorporate aspects of these variations that occur in nature. They don't believe that in many cases that their attractions can just change, that you can just restore creational intent. They see that even there could be a gift in how their experiences are for them, and they could contribute to the body of Christ. And this is actually interesting. There's a letter from C.S. Lewis where he talks about a homosexual man who had written to him, and he had destroyed the letter for the sake of confidentiality. But he said, I wish I could remember this letter because the man wrote to me and he said, I think I have certain sensibilities and a certain like things that I'm good at because of this that I could bring to the church. And what he ended up, C.S. Lewis, with in giving counsel to young Christians who were Bible study leaders, is he said, you have to help people find their vocation, their sense of purpose. Mm. And this person felt that they had that tied to their sexuality. And I think that group, that person you mentioned, is part of a group that's trying to explore that as well. If we have this enduring reality of our same-sex sexuality, and we start with this biblical faithful starting point, but we want to be faithful, and they use the descriptor A as gay, why does that preclude them from being able to serve in these ways? And I kind of agree with them on that. When this study we did, we asked people about the importance of that language, gay Christian. It wasn't important to everybody that we worked with in this study, but for those for whom it was important, they used it for all kinds of reasons. They used it because simply it's the vernacular. You're not going to go to a 16-year-old and say, what's your sexual orientation? And if they happen to have a homosexual orientation, they're not going to say, I have a homosexual orientation, because that fell out of the vernacular. They're going to say, I'm gay. And they're not going to be saying anything to you about their sexual behavior or their theology. They're just answering your question at 16. That's exactly what they would say. So that's the hard part about that is they're in a church with multiple generations where the word gay means something to different people at every generation. To them, it does not mean what their grandparents think it means, you know, or to maybe the senior pastor thinks it means. So the church, the local church, is one of the few places where multiple generations coexist and talk past each other and could mean well, but end up talking past each other. But one of them was the vernacular. The other reason was things like it's missional. I'm part of that community. So I would use words that would help bridge me into that, my own community. I want to be able to represent Christ to other LGBTQ people. And if I start using, you know, what descriptors, same-sex attracted, or, you know, I'm just going to lose people and I'm not even through the front door. So there were like 6 or 7 reasons why people said, I'd like to use this word. It's meaningful to me in these ways. And I thought in that case that you're describing, Brian, there was just looking past all of the nuances of how language could be important to this group of people and saying you won't do it that way or you can't be ordained. And I thought that was just a mistake. Hmm.
And I think this is kind of where I think all three of us find our space in the world is like this blending of like culture and then theology, this idea of like, here's like theological language, but there's also like cultural language and there's cultural ideals and how can they, you know, we're kind of trampling on one in order to make one clear or vice versa. Because I almost think of like how, you know, you have a lot of maybe on the more conservative side of people who don't like the idea of somebody being called a gay Christian, but they also don't like the idea because for them, they hear gay and they hear lifestyle. They don't hear what you just described, Mark, as an orientation, and it's almost like there needs to be so much. I think, especially in the church, and I live in the church area. There's got to be, like any good paper written, our terms really matter, our definitions really matter, and there's I think so much of that talking over each other has to do with, from just simple I don't have the same definition you're working from. I don't know what you mean when you say that. And so maybe I could pivot just a tiny bit on this. I think it's still staying in our framework, but it comes up a lot is the issue of pronouns as we talk about, you know, talking past each other. How do you, you know, so I'm in a classroom and I have 30 students and they want to be identified and there's different, you know, he, him, she, her, you know, they, them. How do we navigate this kind of pronoun conversations today?
So it would depend a little bit on the organization. Like if you're teaching at a place that has a policy around that, I think you're in a different set of considerations. But in general, in my life, a neighbor, extended family member, if I meet somebody, they deliver the pizza and they introduce themselves with their name and their pronouns, I'm going to use their name and their pronouns. And I got a bit of heat for this a few years ago when I wrote this article for Christianity Today, because I explained that to the readership. And I think it's a matter of hospitality to start with where that person is. Because the email I got, a lot of email I got was that it's going back to the integrity, it's a matter of truth telling to use their birth name and their pronouns associated with that. And so they're clearly speaking out of the integrity lens, and it's as though they need to declare that as a gospel imperative in their encounter with this person. See, I understand the impulse there. They believe that they're being honoring to God, and that's a strategic gospel approach to engaging another person. And that's where we agree to disagree. In my view, I would rather build a bridge to that person, respect where they're starting from as a matter of hospitality, and then go from there. Because if I just declare out of one lens, I'm going to speak past them. I've never seen somebody walk away from that kind of a moment and say, wow, they must be really coming at this from a different lens than me. I should ask them more about it. No, they'll say, why are you dead naming me? Why would you insult me like that? They're not going to come back to my home or my church or whatever it is, wherever I'm encountering them. It's very antagonistic, actually, and it's unnecessary. You can still hold your commitments or grapple with those things, but I don't do things that I know will be antagonistic to that person as a matter of that, of just building that relationship with them. Now, there are exceptions. So I'm a psychologist and I see people in my clinical practice. So if I work with a minor and the parents, the minor comes in and introduces themselves by their preferred name, and the parents say, oh, don't do that. We're not there yet. We go by this. I stop the session and I'll say, look, I need the two of you to talk, three of you to talk, and tell me where we go from here, because the teenager's saying this, mom and dad, you're saying this, I'm going to lose one or more of you in the next thing I say. So I need you guys to talk together. And they always work it out. The teenager might say, well, I only told them about this 3 weeks ago. I understand it's okay, but I want to return to this. The parents might say, look, I just want my kid to have someone they can talk to. It's okay. We understand. We're not quite there, but we understand. Or they come up with another solution. Like, you know, this used to be your nickname growing up. Would that be okay? It's not a gendered nickname. Yeah, we can do that. Like, everybody figures this out. So that's the one exception. Otherwise, with an adult or, you know, where everyone's on the same page, I use their name and pronouns.
Before we continue this episode, last week, Phil shared a similar thought at our Sunday morning service at Calvary San Diego. Check it out.
We've become so far from loving God by loving others. We think that loving God means that we're against others. That's how much things have gone out of whack in the Church of Jesus. That I'm going to show you how much I love God by everything I'm against. Read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's the opposite of what Jesus did. He came into a broken world and made himself a sacrifice for all people. Do you know how many people right now are struggling with their own identity of who they are, and you think that by telling them what you think about who they are, that's going to win them to Christ? Are we nuts? No, it's going to happen when we say, I see that you're hurting. How can I be a part of helping you? No, they just need to know the truth. What truth? Your truth? No, my truth is God's truth. Ooh, be very careful. Be very careful. That's not always true, is it? When the church is in a place to, when we become so kind of hyper-focused on like, this is our truth, and we need to make sure people know this. Information is not winning people to Christ, but you reaching out a hand of peace will. This will reach people.
this will not.
If you are listening to this episode, note that Phil held out an open hand after saying, "This will reach people," then pointed his finger to the audience while saying, "This will not." And now back to the show.
Yeah. Yeah. Culture change is a hard one, right? It's hard for us to see these things changing because so often culture is changing pretty slowly in most cases. Language changes pretty slowly, but it does change. And that's what's interesting when people try to go to sort of truth telling as their appeal in this. It's like, well, that's English, you know, like that's English works that way, but like other languages don't work that way. And English didn't even always work that way. You know, that the idea of having these particular pronouns and how these particular pronouns work, that's sort of a moment. And it is stressful to, personally, I am not a fan of the singular they. I mean, I know we use it in our writing and I know, you know, I would rather we make up a new pronoun personally, just because I find it confusing grammatically to be like, they, how many are we talking about? I don't know. But I also know that like in Tagalog and a lot of Philippine languages, there is no gendered singular third person. They just use, you know, siya is the word for both men and women. And so when you hear some Filipinos speaking English, they will often mix. They'll, you know, they'll go back and forth between he and she when they're talking about somebody, just because that's never been a meaningful distinction in the singular third person in their language. So there's not like a truth really in language, I would argue, but I do recognize that seeing culture shift is stressful, and you know that alone causes anxiety in people and gives them a sense of danger, right? When they aren't familiar with what's going on and they feel like they're not controlling what's happening. So it almost seems like a little bit of a control issue around some of the words that we're using here.
Yeah, right. Like I'm going to force you to be referred to by how God made you, kind of a thing. I'm going to control this narrative. You know, it's funny that you said about Tagalog, because in my context of Hungarian in Budapest, Hungary, there is no he, she, it. It's just one ü. We say the word ü. So the table is ü and the woman is ü. You know, it's all the same. So, and yet it's a very, you know, when you talk about the culture of like Budapest, Hungary, underneath like the underbelly of culture, very pro-gay. I mean, it's a massive city that welcomes the gay community across Europe, and yet they don't have the kind of verbiage that we do, you know, here coming to America. All of a sudden it was like the assault of pronouns again that I hadn't used in 22 years, basically, of like, didn't even have to think about that. And you mentioned something, Mark, earlier on this, in that one-on-one kind of a context, that relational connection, you're gonna bridge the gap to address them in a way that works for them, so that you don't have to work on two different levels. What does that look like? You guys are both at Wheaton. Are there policies that are pretty clear from Wheaton's direction that say, no, this is how we address this? Have you seen this working in different academic contexts? I know a lot of public schools are really wrestling with, it's not just that they want to do that. That's not the issue. It's just actually physically being able to do it, remembering and doing it well has been pretty difficult.
Yeah, let me comment on that. Let me step out of Wheaton for a second. Just my role I'm a consultant to a number of Christian colleges, and many of them are grappling with that very question. What do we do? Most do not have a gender policy. All of them would have a policy on sexual behavior, but most would not have a written policy on gender. Several have white papers that are not public, that they're trying to work this out with, you know, their boards and different task forces and things like that. And a few have published them. And so I actually, in a chapter I wrote a couple of years ago, I sort of laid out three examples from three different Christian colleges that in some ways reflected the three lenses I just talked about. So they're not clear, you know, one, but they're leaning that way. So one school leaned the direction of an integrity lens, and the expectation was that students would present in a way that corresponded with their biological sex. And so if that's not a good fit for you, then the policy functions more as a filter. Then this isn't a good fit for you, because that's how we expect you to present. And that's how people will refer to you. Another, and they, and their sort of statement that was available was grounded more in the creation order and things like that. So it kind of fit that more of an integrity lens. Another school did talk about creation, but did talk about the fall. It talked about the ways in which sexuality and gender can be affected by the fall. And if that's your experience, let us know. We'll work with you on a case-by-case basis around housing and restrooms on campus, different things like that. So it was much more of that disability or that variation in nature kind of a conversation. And then the third one, as close as you could get to diversity as a CCCU institution, leaning in that direction was, you know, here's a homepage for your point of contact. If you're transgender, we can help you with help talking to faculty about proper name and pronouns. We can hear single stall, a map of the single stall bathrooms all around campus. We want you to be an educational partner to your peers. Like there was just a very different, they're all CCCU institutions. So I think now they all would have the same proscriptions around sexual behavior and the expectation of marriage between a man and a woman. So that's really interesting. There's consensus there, but on gender and gender identity and gender presentation, quite a bit of variability. And I think you're gonna see that in a lot of CCCU institutions, a lot more differences there than you would see on sex and sex behavior.
Dr. Yarhouse shared how three different Christian colleges had separate viewpoints on cross-gender ideologies. In a moment, Phil will share his thoughts on how he handles the topics of gender identity within his church. Before we get into this, we wanted to share a clip from a previous episode of the podcast titled Threatened by People's Cultural Background. Check it out.
Strangeness is what happens when we don't check our ethnocentrism.
Okay.
So I just let it go. I'm not aware of it. I'm not paying attention. And then strangeness happens because I begin to see things as strange. But strange can sound neutral. It's the idea of like fear and the idea of like
it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, it shouldn't be that way. So I'll give an example. I was with a group of Hungarians who were here in America, and we were touring around speaking at different churches, and most of them don't speak any English. And there was a guy that we were interacting with who obviously didn't speak Hungarian. Yeah. And one of the gals was speaking to me in Hungarian, and she was just saying, hey, can I move these tables to get ready for this, you know, event? Harmless conversation. Mm-hmm. The guy didn't understand, obviously. Ethnocentric. Mm. Freaks out that he doesn't understand the language. And immediately moved into the strangeness effect. So this is what we hear, and people say this all the time. It's this, what is she saying about me?
Oh, gosh.
It's the idea that like they must be talking, they're speaking something I don't understand, so they must be talking about me. Mm. And it's a silly example, but you hear it all the time. Like they must be talking something about me because I don't understand
you
that.
You feel the threat of.
I feel the threat.
Right.
You look at some of these, like they're trying to have a conversation and you hear words like, I feel threatened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from? I mean, obviously it can come from an actual physical threat, but most of the time, and the ones that we all love, you know, the evil loving fascination of watching these like ridiculous conversations is that, you know, somebody feels threatened because they don't understand that person's cultural background. Mm-hmm. And so they're talking in a way that I'm not used to. So I feel threatened. It's an ugly thing.
That clip came from season 1, episode 4, titled, I'm Not Weird, You're Weird, and Other Such Nonsense. You can catch up on previous episodes of Crossing Cultures on any podcast platform or on YouTube. And now, back to the show.
What do you see in Phil, in your church? I mean, you're there in Southern California, which is often considered a pretty progressive kind of part of the country, and you've got a lot of young people in your church, and what's the conversation like there for you?
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, on one hand, I came from a very progressive context of Europe. You know, whenever Christians in America think of Europe, they just think like crazy liberals who don't have any values whatsoever. You know, we're running around the streets naked, don't care, you know, and then coming here and realizing, oh my goodness, there's a lot more, I have to say, in one hand, I see a lot, it's a lot more conservative in America in some areas. Just in general, but then there's language around ideas that we really didn't have in a lot of parts of Europe, especially Eastern Europe, the, you know, former USSR, Soviet Union countries. it's very behind when it comes to, it's not like there's not, you know, homosexuality or any of these. It's just that it's like the language and how to talk about these things is very, very basic and minimal. So coming into San Diego, you know, I got here and I think a week later there was the Pride event and I wanted to go. Our church in Budapest was heavily engaged in trying to connect to the gay community and to let them know like, hey, God is for you. And, you know, your sexual identity doesn't define your, it's a part of your life. It's not your whole life. And, but coming into here and realizing it's such a different, I don't want to say beast in a negative, but just kind of just such a big thing here. We have a school, we have a you know, kindergartners through 12th grade, we have kids, and you gave great advice, Mark, already that I'm really going to utilize because we do have kids that'll come and say, this is how I identify. And, you know, I'm spending a lot of my time the last 4 years trying to redevelop culture that is more missional minded and not just kind of that integrity minded of like, or truth telling. That's a really difficult process. I'm discovering that to be much harder than to just reach a non-Christian is reorienting Christian thought process. But I'm also like, I realize we struggle it within our own home and within our school, like I said, pronouns. So I'm going to take to heart the idea of when I have a young girl, I have a middle schooler talking about that kind of openly and just to say, okay, let's get with your parents and let's align the conversation, because I think we haven't done that. And I'll tell you why. I think because the Christian school in the K-12 is just afraid and everything's reactionary to fear. And so trying to realign that. So I live in these two worlds of like the academic world of K-12 education is a lot of fear-based. The church space that we're in is trying to not be led by fear, and they clash nonstop. It's just a nonstop clashing of how can this person be allowed to be there? But then what do we do about this situation? So will we allow a gay couple to have their kid in our school? These are the kind of things we're wrestling with. The answer, by the way, to be clear on that is yes, because I'm missionally minded. We're here to reach people. And my biggest enemy is not evolution or critical race theory or socialism. It's Christians not living out in a Christ-like manner. That is doing more damage to my 7-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 16-year-olds who are befuddled by the idea of they say they're Christian, but they're living like that, versus that person who's like, I'm not a Christian, but I want my kids to be influenced by a Christian ethic. Who do I want influencing? What's the bigger danger? These are the issues that we're wrestling with here. Obviously, California leads the way, I think. Whether we say that is a good thing or a bad thing, we lead the way in a lot of these issues. And I really feel like coming from a post-Christian European context, I feel more equipped for the California ministry than I think a lot of people who have been embedded here for decades are at this moment, if that makes some sense.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Mark, to you, because I've thought about this, you know, the ways that like the Christian home or the Christian community itself can really, you know, hinder some of the ways in which people might experience or think about some of these things. And I always have wondered if like a lot of folks who are wrestling with gender identity, what they're really wrestling with are rigid gender roles, right? That they've been given these very narrow gender roles. This is what it means to be a man. This is what it means to be a woman. And they're usually drawn from a very specific moment in kind of US cultural history. And they don't feel connected to that, or they see the disadvantages perhaps of those gender roles. And so they interpret that as transgenderism, or they interpret that as gender dysphoria, or like, is that a place in which, you know, maybe the church in sort of pushing the, I don't know, pushing isn't the right word, but in holding to this integrity model of order, that they've also grasped onto some pretty narrow views of what it means to be a man and a woman that have maybe hurt some people?
Yeah, we have a lot of kind of rigid gender stereotypes, particularly for boys growing up. In fact, what we used to see at most gender clinics was about a 4-to-1 ratio of boys to girls referred for gender atypicality, we would call it, in childhood. But I think it's because the box for what a boy can do is much narrower for them, or And so when they're outside of that, it's a red flag for them. But for girls, there's it's more expansive. So a girl, there's even positive language in English. She can be a tomboy and nobody raises an eyebrow, but there's not a corresponding English word for a boy to be outside of that. And it's really a risk because what happens is a lot of parents, in response to gender atypical presentations, will double down on gender stereotypes. And so, Phil, you mentioned like reducing fears at the K through 12. And I work with K through 12s as well with those types of policy questions. And what you see with families, with parenting, is when I work with parents, it's reducing fear-based ways of parenting. Because when parents parent out of fear, they usually regret it. And so they'll double down on gender stereotypes. And these kids growing up will look back on their childhood and say, that was damaging to me. What you did was really painful to me because I wasn't enough as I was. You needed me to be a tough guy, a boy who would play football, and I didn't want to play football. And, you know, all these stereotypes. So that can be really, really harmful to kids. Now, Brian, you also brought the question of just like not conforming to gender roles and expectations. Mm-hmm. That's actually, for a psychologist, that's actually a rule out to get you to the diagnosis of gender dysphoria. You can't diagnose someone with gender dysphoria who's just not conforming to gender role expectations for being a boy or being a girl. That's actually something you take off the table, just as there's a lot of rule outs to make sure that you're getting gender dysphoria, and that would be one of them.
So okay, do you think, and I know we have to wrap up here pretty soon, but do you think that just on that point right there, because that's such really, really helpful stuff. Do you think that like for most parents or teachers or people in like, you know, youth pastors, as you mentioned, or senior pastors, we would be better served doing more listening rather than like the jumping to the conclusions? Because as you said, like, you know, there's a ruling out kind of that happens. I mean, not everybody who says one thing actually even believes that. I mean, again, talking with young people, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, you know, in that age range, they're using phrases that they don't fully understand yet. So they're saying, I'm this, but they don't really know what that means. And I don't mean that as a judgment against them, just simply to say that the more questions I would ask, the more I would hear, well, no, I don't feel that way. Or no, that's not what I meant. And so I wonder if we're needing to learn to listen better and speak less on these matters.
Yeah. So I hate to keep dropping books on you here, but
it's helpful. Please drop them.
So just about a year ago, I published a book called Emerging Gender Identities, and it was to update the evangelical community on what's happened since 2015. So in the last 6 years, what has changed in the landscape? And a lot of it's about some of the controversies in care, how psychologists are approaching this, specialty clinics, things like that. But when I said emerging gender identities, I really meant not just transgender. Think about a 14-year-old today. They are exposed to so many more terms and language and linguistic constructs and ways of thinking about gender that you as a reader, you as a mom and dad never were exposed to. So not just transgender, pangender, bigender, agender, gray gender, gender expansive, gender creative. And your 14-year-old is navigating that socially as an embodied gendered being with a splintering of those norms that are available to them on a horizon that seems endless. So rather than take a disputational, I'm disputing you posture or a fear-based way of overreacting, try to empathize a little bit with what it would be like to be 14 and have all of that in front of you, that open horizon, so many different ways of thinking about your gender. Enter into that world a little bit and listen to them and help them think about these concepts as a Christian. That would be more the angle of entry into that conversation as a parent or a youth minister.
Oh, that's really powerful. And we should probably wrap up. I don't want to take up any more of both of your times. It's been a solid hour of great conversation. Mark, thank you so much for taking the time when Brian and I were talking about like good shows. This is a highlight of just, it's so relevant. Thank you for dropping all the books you can. I'm going to have to get them, send them to you, have you autograph them and send them back. Because it's excellent stuff. It's very relevant to where things are. And that's you know, our conversation started with cultural anthropology is so relevant for the needs today. And I can't think of another topic and another area that's not just as relevant. And that's the area that you're dealing, that you're working in and really leading in. So thank you for doing that. Brian, do you have any final thoughts?
Well, I just want to extend my thanks as well. I mean, obviously, when we thought about this topic, I said, oh, I got the guy. I definitely have the guy that we need to talk to. And I would encourage anybody who really wants to know more about this. Mark has a number of books that are geared towards psychology and professionals who are working in the field, but also many that are geared towards the church and people who just want to understand this issue better. You know, obviously you can go on Amazon or, you know, some less predatory company and find, you know, all his books listed there and, you know, really educate yourself just by reading the stuff that Mark has done on this. So we really appreciate you spending time with us today, Mark, because this has been really helpful.
Oh, thank you so much. It's just been an honor just to be asked and to have this time to think through these things together. It's always good for me. So thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to Crossing Cultures. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our YouTube channel or any podcast platform. To receive notifications of when new episodes are released, click the bell icon on our profile page. We also have previous seasons with loads of discussions on topics like race and the gospel, Ukrainian refugee crisis, and more. Follow us and take a look back on what God has been doing on the show. This is our last episode of season 5 of Crossing Cultures. We are excited to share more conversations on culture in the seasons to come. So stay tuned for more updates on season 6 of Crossing Cultures. This episode was produced by Phil Metzger and Dr. Brian Howell and edited by Luis Lopez. Our special guest this week is Dr. Mark Yarhouse. This podcast is the ministry of Calvary San Diego. I'm your host, Kia Lopez, and stay tuned for updates on season 6 of Crossing Cultures as we learn to engage with people who live, think, and believe differently than we do.